Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexiderm. We are joined by A.B. Stoddard of Real Clear Politics. A.B., thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me, Charlie.
We got a roll on this because we're just listening to the president's press conference / meltdown where he's saying, among other things, the Kurds are much safer right now, but the Kurds know how to fight. As I said, they're not angels. They're not angels. Okay, so Ben Parker, you stuck around. What else did the president say?
This is the quote that's making the rounds. Quote, Syria may have some help with Russia, and that's fine. It's a lot of sand. They've got a lot of sand over there, so there's a lot of sand they can play with.
It's so unbelievable that Senator Graham and the Charlie Sykes piece on Senator Graham is still like a hall of famer. I cannot tell you how many emails I've gotten about it, and I need to pass on all the love to you. But
thank you.
Senator Graham, as we all know, sent out like this 2-page statement basically letting us know that cleanup on aisle 18 had begun and everyone was to kumbaya and support the president's new efforts to mitigate this disaster that isn't his fault and it's all the fault of Erdogan. And Erdogan, the president of Turkey, had underestimated President Trump and Senator Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham is neither chairman of the Armed Services Committee nor is he chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. Both men are hiding in a basement and are completely mute. And Lindsey Graham has finally pulled this together. We have Vice President Mike Pence and Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, going off to meet with Erdogan, who says things like, I'm not going to meet with them. There will be no ceasefire. Maybe I'll meet with them. And while they're out on this mission to ask for a ceasefire, the president basically undercuts the entire thing and says the Kurds are on their own. There are no angels. It's no problem. And that they should go play in the sand.
Yeah. And he says his decisions have been strategically brilliant, which I guess is sort of just normalized. You know, I right before we started this podcast, I said I'm going to apologize. I just find myself swearing more often, not just on the podcast, but I'm just looking at my Twitter feed and going, oh my gosh, because at certain points I'm just out of words. And my reaction to this is, and this will get us an explicit rating, you know, watching the president sitting in the Oval Office talking about the Kurds are safer, you know, and attacking the Kurds, they're not angels. And the only thing that came to my mind was this man is going to drown in his own bullshit if he doesn't drown us first.
Yeah.
And it is just extraordinary.
Yeah. I know it's true. And it's just so awful that people in the military, on national security reporters, you know, devoted patriotic employees who have, you know, worked in this system their whole life and are very worried about our men and women in uniform who are over there having to be evacuated in an incredibly dangerous situation. Then we'll never go back in. And that's another conversation. But and he's tweeting about the debates in the most superficial, childish, disgusting way this morning while this is ongoing. And then lying about the Kurds and literally telling them to pound sand. But I don't want you to feel any guilt, Charlie, because this is Trump's America. Now he openly swears at his rallies in front of small children. So I think he's giving us like a clue that, you know, beyond all the norm smashing, we're not going to hold back on the 4-letter bombs anymore.
I figured that I'm just going to go along with it. So speaking of Lindsey Graham has been so trying to find a way to get back into, you know, his normal sycophantic mode. And this morning he's on a tweet storm right now. Let me just look at what he's tweeting. He said the statements
because
by President
the president
Trump,
hung him out to dry.
Totally hung him out to dry. And everybody else. The statement by President Trump about Turkey's invasion being of no concern to us completely undercut Vice President Pence and Secretary Pompeo's ability to end the conflict. No kidding. He goes on, I hope President Trump is right in his belief that Turkey's invasion of Syria is of no concern to us. Abandoning the Kurds won't come back to haunt us. ISIS won't reemerge and Iran will not fill the vacuum created by this decision. However, I firmly believe that if President Trump continues to make such statements, this will be a disaster worse than President Obama's decision to leave Iraq. Now, this means it'll probably be 72 hours rather than 24 hours before Lindsey Graham crawls back into the dark, comfortable place that he spent the last several years in. But it is extraordinary. And it's, you know, Charles Krauthammer once wrote that, you know, decline is a choice. And we are seeing it playing out in real time. These images that we're getting of the Russians basically doing the happy dance in the abandoned American military bases is one thing. Erdogan this morning basically saying that he's not going to meet with Vice President Pence. He changed his mind on that, but blowing off any idea of a ceasefire, saying he's not at all interested in the United States mediating. This is really what irrelevance feels like. It's what weakness looks like. And somebody tweeted out that the fact that Erdogan would even have said these things, you know, entertained the possibility of stiffing the vice president, is really an indication of our diminished role in the Middle East and something he never would have done to Vladimir Putin.
Absolutely. That's exactly how much it made my stomach hurt to read his, you know, defiance in the face of the vice president of the United States and Secretary of State of the United States coming to, you know, they were going to call for a ceasefire for domestic political reasons, but they were going to try to get him what? Not invade Kobani, certain things, right? That the, some kind of deliverables, which has become a bad word because it's part of Ukraine gate, but, you know, that they would be able to say that they had done something at the highest levels to convince Erdogan to slaughter fewer Kurds or whatever. And for him to be that openly defiant on the world stage is such a sign of how much leverage and respect and strength we've lost. And it's terrifying. And that's why it was so hard to be reading at the same time simultaneously the childish tweets about the debate contenders and how none of them seemed like they could ever be president and the stock market would crash and Trump so perfect. I mean, he really has no concept of what he did. He has no concept of what's to come, how endangered our troops are that are there until they're gone. This is something we don't do often. Evacuate people from a combat zone. The Turks have actually used some provocations in recent days against our troops, and they know exactly where they are. So it's really incredibly provocative. And then you know, we have the nuclear weapons that are going to be that remain in Turkey that we have to make a decision. I mean, this can get so much worse, Charlie. And the president is drowning in his own BS and trying to, you know, drag us down to this level. And you know, Liz Cheney and Lindsey Graham and these people are going to have to make a choice. You know, you can only blame the Democrats and the media and the Mexicans for so long on all this stuff and on everything, which is what they usually do. But, you know, they're really going to have to find a way to stop the metaphoric bleeding. This is really going to be a difficult operation in the days and weeks to come. And it's terrifying. Forget that's like apart from the long term damage that, you know, I started my long answer with, which is that we can't get back what we've lost. It could take decades.
And given the president's decision making prowess, it's not necessarily going to get any better. Okay, I want to talk to you a little bit later on the podcast about your piece that you had at Real Clear Politics, where you think that Democrats are making a big mistake by rushing impeachment, and I want to go through all of that. But first, you know, you mentioned the president is tweeting about the debate. We all watched the debate. So, what is your take on the debate? I'm looking at a lot of the conventional wisdom out there, but I will tell you what my just gut take was. I was really impressed with Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar. And I think we got the first glimpse of how vulnerable Elizabeth Warren is going to be going forward. But that's just sort of my surface take. What did you think happened last night?
Well, I thought it was 3 hours of pretty much torture.
Who watches 3 hours?
It is really interesting because a lot of Democratic voters say I can't watch these things until there's an actual race. So many quote Democrats who are not, like, you know, grassroots, like left wing, primary voters, they're not watching. But I do think I sort of agree with everything you said, Charlie. I thought that Buttigieg came to really contrasts himself with everybody. Very aggressive. He was very good at cutting into Warren. So was Biden on her impossible math. And I thought that Klobuchar also is really growing in this, and she's was more confident. And people say she comes across as honest and clear, and that that it was just a very interesting night in that way. I thought it went on too long, and I heard too many of the repeated talking points and the points in the posturing and the gimmicks. But those were good surprises, because I've been worried all along about the fact that there was no moderate option besides, you know, after Biden. So without Bennett there, without Bullock there, without Ryan there, you know, with it just was really good that the middle kind of, you know, fought back. I thought that Biden was able to make the case when it came to Syria that, you know, that this is a scary time and the damage has been so extensive that only someone like him is really going to be positioned to clean it up. That said, Biden has tons of problems. Right after the debate, we found out he's burned through too much money. I mean, he's, you know, that there's no question that the Democrats have a lot of problems facing Trump next year. I think it's a divided party. The idea that Bernie would release his, you know, squad endorsements also before the debate was over. I mean, we're looking at a long fight, but it's very fluid. Things can change. And I welcome, you know, the center pushing back on all these things that positions that Bernie and Elizabeth and some people have taken that poll like at 29% and are radical ideas and, you know,
well, this
are
is this
electoral
is,
losers.
You had a piece in the Bulwark, I think it was last week. I've lost track of time. Everything seems like it's in a time warp now. But
which is part of my impeachment argument. We'll get to that later. The virtual calendar.
Making the case that Biden needed to take control of the narrative. Now, we saw their first big initiative yesterday. Hunter Biden goes out and gives that the interview to ABC, and then of course the Biden's performance last night. So how do you grade him on what you said he should do? How much of what you recommended?
Right after the
done?
Piece came out, which definitely made its way to the Biden campaign in some way or several ways. You know, they knew they had a problem. I wasn't the first to raise it, clearly. But he made some remarks that night in Reno, Nevada, late at night, that got picked up by nobody. I mean, it was just some passing thoughts on MSNBC, maybe. And my advice was, you have to go viral. You have to have an address to the nation, which you can do as vice president. And it has to include some surprises so that it would get good coverage, so that it would speak to people waiting in line, you know, for a flight at an airport, you know, that it, not just the people who are paying attention to the primary. And he did not do that. I recommended counter programming to the Rudy tweets and the Eric Trump lies and the Don Jr. tweets and the Trump tweets, and to just have someone sitting there and just kicking back at everyone. They don't seem interested in doing that. So they're still trying to sort of, you know, play the old game. And the Hunter Biden interview, which I don't think was a bad idea, but was strangely timed. You know, I thought he did a pretty good job. I thought it was sort of the right and humble thing to do, saying, I don't know if I've ever gotten an opportunity that wasn't connected to my last name, or I don't know exactly how he said it. But it was kind of, I thought it was smart to just sort of embrace that, like, children of very powerful people are given opportunities that none of us else would, you know, else would have. And that's just the truth. And it's cronyism. It is.
It is.
But it's not, you know, what the Trump children are doing in office. It's not potentially, you know, it wasn't violating the emoluments clause.
Well, that's what's been extraordinary in the last 24 hours. The, you know, whether you want to call it the gaslighting or the projection or anything, watching Don Jr. And other folks, you know, deride nepotism. It's like, you know, Don, maybe you ought to sit this one out. You know, that there's no question about it. There's something swampy. There is something.
And the,
you know,
RNC chairwoman, too, put out a tweet using the word nepotism. It's not really a word I would really embrace if I was like a Republican trying to get him reelected. I mean, anyway.
No, I think it was Chris Hayes who's come up with the phrase the Jedi mind tricks that they use, which is that it's not just gaslighting. It's like whatever you see with your eyes, no, you're not actually seeing it. It's not actually happening here. And so, yeah, there is this sort of, you know, the swampy cronyism of Hunter Biden, which does turn people off. But then you compare it and contrast it to just the overt corruption of what the Trump family is doing on a regular basis with the emoluments. And then, of course, the reason we're talking about it is the corrupt effort to get a foreign government to dig up dirt on all of this. And yet it is the brazenness of it that I think is breathtaking.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and that's the way they are. I mean, Trump is, it's beyond gaslighting. It's really a sort of a tyrant 101 thing that he's doing, where he's trying to tell us that the sky is black. He tells us every day that the phone call with Zelensky was perfect, the president of Ukraine, even though we have what they said is an unredacted transcript, but it's reconstructed. I'm not so clear on whether
it's
or not
a real
everything.
Transcript. Yeah,
but basically, no one likes what they saw on his version that they gave. I mean, a majority of people think what he did was wrong in the version that he gave us, and then he keeps telling us it's something else. And that's classic Trump. It's beyond lying. It is. It's the most bizarre thing. But I want to say on Biden that because I think that for people who are not, again, like in Bernie's camp and want to take down Joe or something, you know, if you're just a voter that like doesn't like Trump and is looking at the Democratic field, because the Hunter thing actually has ended up leading to Trump's impeachment, it's not a clean hit on Biden. So although it's awkward, like my son who struggled, and I had this one son who was like in the service and then, you know, also Attorney General of Delaware. And then I had this other son who struggled, and he ended up having to get jobs because of me. And he is a drug addict on and off, you know, really struggling addict at times in his life. It's just too hard for Joe Biden, you know, to explain it beyond a few words because it's so wrapped around his son's struggle. Personal struggles. But I do think, like I said, for the person who's just walking through the airport at that level of paying attention, it's not such a clean hit because it is they have found out that it ended up leading after all that Trump has done to this impeachment.
Okay, so on the debate, going back to Mayor Pete, I thought had a really extraordinarily strong performance. I thought, you know, his smackdown of Beto O'Rourke was strong. His pushback against Tulsi Gabbard, I think, was his highlight. He was very aggressive in going after Elizabeth Warren. I think you're right, Amy Klobuchar also definitely upped her game. But, you know, this is one of those moments where we, who are the political, you know, we're the nerds, need to step back and realize that normal people are not watching this. So, you know, is it going to make any sort of a difference? I mean, going into that debate yesterday, it was increasingly looking like a two-person race. With everything that happened in that three-hour talkathon, did anything actually change? Now, I think that Mayor Pete and Amy Klobuchar, you know, earned themselves a second long look, but that's just me, and that doesn't mean, well, does that actually mean anything on the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire?
I think it does, because the people who are watching the debates are donors and political activists and primary voters in those first early states who are, you know, very active. And I think that it is going to likely mean the survival for someone like Amy Klobuchar, who has not qualified for the next debate. She could have a good next 10 days and get some poll bump or money that could help her get there. And then for Buttigieg, who has all the money because people think he's really a star, but had not been bumped, you know, he hasn't seen the polling, the polling strength. He's recently surpassed Harris in some polls and is now number four. And so he has become this kind of Iowa dark horse, and people really like him. It's a very white state. His liability is African-American and Latino voters, mostly African-American. So if he starts cutting into some Elizabeth Warren voters in Iowa, that's a big thing. This is still a fluid situation, and I think that it will move some money around. It'll move some support around. I think Harris has finished herself off. I don't know how she comes back if she keeps saying the same thing over and over again. So canned.
Yeah.
It's really, she doesn't have a message for her campaign, and she never has. So I do think if you look at a couple of people, you know, let's say people take a second look at Elizabeth Warren last night, she's going to raise my taxes. She just won't admit it. If they look at, you know, if they're like a wavering Biden supporter, maybe he made them happy last night by saying, like, I'm the only one that knows what we're getting into. And then I think you take a second look if you're, you know, some people just want people to stay in the race. You know, they're not sure that they want them yet, but, you know, they gave to Booker when he begged for money 10 days ago to keep going. And they gave to him because they want him in the race. So I actually think it really could help Klobuchar and Buttigieg. I think that last night could hurt Harris. And I think that, you know, Warren's probably excited a lot of people last night, but she's probably doing some blocking and tackling after
last
night.
Well, you know, I'm seeing a lot of the conventional wisdom out there, you know, saying that, you know, she dominated the debate. She was the winner of the debate because clearly she was being treated as the front runner because everybody was attacking her. And I certainly get that. On the other hand, I do think that you started to, maybe the Democrats might have started to realize that many of the issues that were being raised will be issues that would be a real liability in a general election, and that because she is the media darling, and I come back to that in a second, you know, that she hasn't gotten a free pass. There's no question about that, but she has skated on a lot of this stuff. Now, David Beiler had a really interesting piece in the Washington Post a little while back, you know, asking why has she gotten so much favorable treatment, and he said, Warren's campaign and candidacy are built to resonate with the organization kids who populate the national media, and many journalists either match the demographic profile of her base or live around people who do. And so as a result, she's moving toward the nomination without having to answer fundamental questions that are going to be very much on voters' minds in places like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Minnesota. Like, for example, who's going to pay for all of her ideas? And I think she did come off as evasive. She did come off, you know, the woman who has all planned for everything, didn't have a lot of answers for some of those things. And at some point, she's going to have to come up with those.
I think it was clear from a few of the both the moderators and the other candidates going back at her that she wants you to know that she's going to keep costs down, but she never addressed whether or not she'll raise taxes. So that was, I think, a problem for her. And I think that, you know, if you watch her, she's really good at making sure she spends time with voters, but she doesn't do a lot of interviews. She recently gave CNN one with her and her husband, but she's not answering a lot of those questions. And I think she avoids it for a reason.
Yeah, there's a reason for that. Okay, so let's switch gears and talk about impeachment, because there's so much. We're in this this moment where it's difficult to keep up once again. I feel like we've said this many times before, with the pace of the news cycle. We have a big Washington Post story. Mulvaney emerges as key facilitator of the campaign to pressure Ukraine. This one of the top advisors to Pompeo is testifying about the politicization of the State Department in all of this. More and more folks from the administration are going up to testify behind closed doors in the impeachment proceeding. And of course, the Rudy Giuliani story just gets messier and messier and messier. Both he and Mike Pence have made it clear that they have no intention of cooperating in any way with the congressional investigation. Democrats met yesterday in closed session to discuss, because they're back in Washington, discussing whether or not they ought to have a formal vote to initiate the inquiry. And the word that that came out afterwards is that they're going to hold off on that. So let's talk about your piece. You are one of those voices saying, hey, slow it down. There is no rush, because there's a lot of folks in our world who are saying, look, get on with it. You have the evidence. What are you waiting for? So let's talk about that right after this word from our sponsor.
Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear, so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to TryPlexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com.
Okay, we are back with A.B. Stoddard from Real Clear Politics, a contributor also to the Bulwark. All right, you have a contrarian piece. Democrats are making a big mistake by rushing impeachment. What do you mean? There are folks who say, look, you have all of the evidence. You've had the Mueller report for months. You have the transcript or the quasi-transcript of that phone call. You have the president's clear obstruction of this investigation. Why not have the vote? Why not get it all done by Thanksgiving?
Right. So there are so many good arguments for rushing it. People believe that he needs to be deterred from committing future crimes, that because he was not punished for obstruction of justice after the 10 counts in the Mueller report, he went ahead and meddled in the next election and could be working to continue to do that if he isn't stopped. So so they see it as a, you know, an emergency. And much smarter people than me are weighing in, legal minds from the left, Lawrence Tribe, to the right, George Conway, Philip Reines, who worked for the Hillary Clinton campaign, joined with Tom Nichols, a Republican, to put a piece in the USA Today last week saying that there is enough there, do it now. So when I speak to Democratic staff in the background, you know, of this, they say things like, we have this now, we have the hot hand now. And so that when you have that, you have to move. And they also believe that the voters can only focus on so much, and there's like a focus problem. My contrarian argument is that this is an ever-expanding government-wide, not the entire government, but so broadly throughout the West Wing and into the State Department and into the offices of Rudy Giuliani in New York and around different hotspots in the world, and the ambassador to the European Union, and on, there are so many people who are now complicit from their knowledge of it or were actively participating in it. Mike Pence, Rick Perry, Bill Barr, Rudy Giuliani, Mike Pompeo, Mick Mulvaney, Mr. Eisenberg, the counsel at the NSC. There are so many people that knew about a shakedown happening at the highest levels of government with the highest level of, you know, resources and expertise, that was a de facto sort of political campaign operation that was not in the interests of our national security objectives. And the idea that the Democrats would just hurl this out there by Thanksgiving, piling up a bunch of defied subpoenas as an obstruction charge, which the public is not going to digest, and then just send it to the Senate where Mitch McConnell could say, I took it up, but then I dispensed with it. He might not even hold a trial because of something I quoted he said on CNBC about how, you know, you have to bring it up, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't say how much time we have to spend on it. The idea, Charlie, that they would be able to say we can't really impeach him over one phone call when this clearly now involves Turkey. The president treats President Erdogan as a once and future client. Rudy Giuliani has now been lobbying the U.S. government, his buddy Donald Trump, the president, on two high priorities to the Turkish government, both the Iranian Turkish gold trader who was running a sanctions busting operation, stopping that from going to trial, and in addition, trying to get this cleric extradited from Pennsylvania to Turkey, another Erdogan wish. There's so much here, and I'm sorry to be like vomiting it out like a machine gun, but this goes on and on. There's so many Russian ties, and the idea that they would just say, oh, well, they didn't show up for a bunch of meetings, so we're going to send articles of impeachment out by the end of the year, nothing would make Senate Republicans and President Trump happier. You could, in the mind meld that we're in, impeach him next October and people wouldn't remember it on election day, because no one can remember that the president invited the Taliban to Camp David 6 weeks ago. But I'll remind everyone listening that he did. And so we don't remember anything when anything happened anymore. So if they do this in February and March, and they bring several articles about multiple crimes, and it's extensive, and the SDNY is going after more guys. By the way, they just picked up another Rudy crony at JFK. I mean, if this is devastating, you're going to get eight senators. Is it going to be a conviction? No, it's not. But it's going to be bipartisan. And why? Because Mitch McConnell wants to be majority leader more than he wants President Trump to be president. And he will do what he can to protect his people. And he has several guys retiring. And if this gets really bad, they're going to vote with the Democrats.
So you wrote, Democrats need to use these months for an investigation that will further educate voters about what a threat to the balance of power in our constitutional democracy the president's conduct combined with a subpoena blockade represents, and that under the Constitution he is not empowered to defy impeachment or congressional investigation. Democrats should also be advocating for and campaigning on badly needed reforms, such as the requirement for disclosure of any campaign help from foreign governments. And you're right, there's so much stuff that's going on. I guess the counter argument would be that it is better to be focused, to have a rifle shot, rather than follow down all of these rabbit holes. And there are so many rabbit holes that could theoretically take forever and become intensely confusing. So my sense is right now that the Democrats haven't managed to, you know, boil this down into the killer, sound bites yet. Now, by the way, having just said that, we have a new poll out showing that 52% of Americans now favor impeachment and removal from office. So I guess the argument would be, okay, strike while the iron is hot. Public opinion is behind you. If you follow where you're going, these investigations could become both convoluted and almost endless.
I understand that. I really do. And I'm saying it's, I mean, I do understand at some point you have to cut it off, but letting him be acquitted in a partisan vote early in this, sort of investigation, like the UK, I say in the piece, you can only impeach once. Like, right. This idea that they can impeach
one
now.
Shot.
We're going to keep everything open and investigate, and we'll impeach him later on other things. Like, no, you won't. You do it once. You really only have one shot. So if you're going to have one shot, would it be better to be bipartisan? Would it be better for it to really move public opinion and sort of, as Jim Himes, I quoted him in the piece, the congressman from Connecticut, get to the bottom of the story? So, yes, it could be endless. It could take years, and you don't want to do that. But I would say Thanksgiving is too abrupt, and it's a clean partisan acquittal is really what he wants.
Okay.
Any attempt to impeach him, Charlie, in a second term for crimes that are more grave and consequential would be impossible. This is the one shot.
After he is reelected. We're going to be having an extensive debate here on this podcast about this. We're going to talk to Adam White, who also makes the point that the Democrats are running the risk of undermining their case by not following certain rules of due process. We're going to talk to Tom Nichols as well. So let's just talk about the vote on the inquiry. Could they, in terms of the calendar, vote reasonably soon to initiate the inquiry and then do what you describe, spend then months pursuing this before having the formal vote? Is that consistent with your view of the calendar?
Yes. And in the piece, I recommend they take that formal vote because I think it's a stupid talking point for the White House. They are not going to cooperate anymore if there's a formal vote. I do know that the Republicans have some good arguments. I mean, you fight on process when you can't fight on substance, and I get that. So it's not really that they don't want their Trumpistic Democrats to be on the record in favor of an inquiry, because an inquiry is not articles of impeachment. It's just the beginning of a process. I think the speaker is probably more hesitant to do this because she doesn't want to formalize a process which would have to empower the minority in some way with subpoena rights or other powers that she doesn't want to grant them. And on that point, I think Republicans have an argument. I'll be interested to see how your debate unfolds on the podcast. But I do think that what's interesting about this week, Charlie, is that the revelations have come so quickly and they've been so profound from Hill to Kent to now we have McKinley today, all these people testifying to all these shenanigans. Those revelations have come and overpowered the process arguments. So it is true, if you get to a long stretch without revelations, people are going to jump up and down about process. But I think it's worth taking the vote and maybe giving them some, I don't know, some rights that, you know, they had, the Democrats had in the Clinton process or something. I don't know how they worked that out. I'm not a lawyer, but
the legitimacy.
Back to that paragraph. Yeah. I do think that they need to say it's official. They're not playing games. Take away the talking point, and then they need to go to the voters and explain to them that impeachment is not removal, that the Congress is a separate and co-equal branch with the power of oversight that has always been backed by the courts, and that they are a check on this president, and that the president is not allowed to form a blockade of this process. And so I think that takes time. I think people they didn't know what Russian collusion was. People are busy with their lives, and they actually believe that impeachment is like you go to the guillotine or something. Like, I just don't think that Nancy Pelosi has found this problem. And so I think, you know, some time to let it sort of for people to soak it up at home would be, you know, they'd be well served by.
Okay,
that.
So what is the ideal month for the vote? I heard you say February.
Yeah, I'm thinking like in the winter. I mean, is someone on Election Day after there's like a devastating pile of articles backed by evidence, not backed by block subpoenas in an obstruction charge, real evidence with some court decisions having come back, some documents having been dumped, some more leakers having left the sinking ship, which I think we're going to continue to see more of. I think something in the winter, no one will say on Election Day, boy, those Democrats, they pushed it into an election year. Like, that was really wrong for them to hold this on March 5th. Like I said, no one will remember what happened because in Trump's America, everything, the onslaught causes us to lose track of time and we can never remember anything. Last week always seems like 6 months ago. So I don't think they harmed themselves. I would not wait until all the Republican primaries are over. That takes you into the summer. Like I said, I do think that there is no world. There's no conviction. I've made a list. There's only 15 possible people. That is the outskirts. You don't get to 20. However, I think I've looked at the people I think get you to 8, and I think a really devastating case combined with the people who are up in vulnerable races with some retirees who'd like to be on the right pages of the history books gets you to, 8, which is that's a bipartisan majority in
so
favor.
So who are the 8?
Oh, am I supposed to say that?
Can you?
Okay.
I don't know.
So retiring members are Burr, Enzi, Roberts, Isaacson, Alexander. Then you add Romney, you're at 6 already. Then, obviously, in a righteous world, Ben Sasse and Mike Lee would join. I'm not counting them. I'm thinking Collins Gardner. I'm thinking, depending on how the polls are looking, McSally. Tough race. How are the farmers? How are the polls in Iowa? Possibly Joni Ernst. Does Rob Portman wake up one day? Again, he's in my Mike Lee Ben Sasse basket, but obviously would be someone in this group of, people who are more wedded to their country and the process and the system that we have than tribal holds on power. I think I'm being conservative.
Yeah, but that illustrates
maybe
how
I'm in
hard
a fantasy, but I'm
20.
Being I'm th- yeah, no, it's yeah. You don't get to 20. No. My whole 15, my 15 goes, it's like everyone running for re-election plus that's not my 15. Yeah. I don't think we've got 15, right, Ben? But anyway, 15 was my outer and oh, Murkowski was, yeah.
So, Murkowski.
So, yeah, Murkowski's. So let's say you get 8 of those guys, right? I mean, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
Adding to the Democrats. That's a bipartisan vote, and that's devastating.
Okay, so you talk to people on Capitol Hill, and we've known that there's been this phenomenon of people behind closed doors saying one thing and then being reluctant to say it in public. Has anything changed in light of what's been going on with Syria or these revelations post-Ukraine? Are you picking up any different? Are they more rattled? Are they more concerned? What do you sense is happening?
Right. Well, I was fascinated by your conversation with Bill about this over the weekend because I do know that the pushback on Syria was so vocal and swift and emphatic, almost like they were talking about Hillary Clinton or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. It was just so visceral. But that still is not connected to, his removal or impeachable offenses, right? Because that's just like a policy disagreement. And so,
Different category, different box.
Right. And so even though you have people like George Conway and Scaramucci telling them that this is also emblematic of the fact that he's unfit and he will continue to make bad decisions and drown himself in BS and drama and sort of thrash around as he faces more political peril, which might be the case, right? I don't think you connect the two. So does it give them more appetite for removal? Absolutely not. But it compounds the cumulative fatigue and frustration and the sort of knowledge that this guy is going to take the party down the tubes and he could win again, but that they're kind of tied to this sinking ship, and it's just like heading in one direction. And I think that if you think about the fact that we're in for a few more surprises, I mean, we really are.
Yeah, there's more.
I mean, I think the SDNY has been like wiretapping Rudy Giuliani. There's potential serious peril here. And like I said, really, what are you doing when your Secretary of State and your Vice President and your Chief of Staff like all knew about that? I mean, this could go to a much darker place.
Which, by the way, is a good argument in favor of your, hey, slow your roll, guys, because
right,
you know, don't pull the trigger, because there's a lot coming.
Because Republicans and Trump want to get this dispensed with before the revelations to come.
That's a really good point, that if you're Trump, you want to get past this as quickly as possible.
It's one phone call.
Here's a very interesting tweet while we're talking here. David Brody from, was it Christian Broadcast Network?
Yes, yes.
I think it's fair to characterize him as a complete Trump hack.
David is my friend.
Oh,
and
I'm
he we have many disagreements, and he definitely it was interesting actually to watch his reporting on the evangelical reaction.
Well, this is what I wanted to read you.
To the Syria stuff a week ago, because Pat Robertson basically said he'd lose the mandate of heaven or something, and then there was like a wagon circling. So they've been sort of in a few places.
Here's the tweet that was 3 minutes ago or so, while we're taping this, all in caps, devastating exclamation point. Lindsey Graham lowers the boom on real Donald Trump today on 700 Club, says, quote, don't be like Obama, and then he'll become Trump's worst nightmare, says that the president is practicing, quote, Elizabeth Warren politics in the Mideast, and then he links to the full interview, which is like, whoa, okay. So Lindsey is out there going to the hardest of the hardcore Trump base. Although, as you point out, Pat Robertson has been willing to say that this is such a big deal, you lose the mandate of heaven. This is the first time that I can recall that the president has risked alienating his evangelical conservative base. I just don't remember when he's done that before.
I don't either. I don't either. And it's amazing, because the message he got from them last year was clear. Last week was clear enough that I would have thought he was going to be running to clean this up.
Yes, I do too. Yeah,
because he's usually so responsive to that.
Why do you think he didn't? That's a really good point.
It is a wonder. And unless he really, you know, knowingly, intentionally is trying to advance the foreign policy objectives of the Russian Federation. But I do think that David Brody has told me before that if his number drops below 80% with the evangelical vote, he loses election. And the idea that Lindsey Graham trolled him with the name Obama and Elizabeth Warren and went on CBN is very interesting, because you know, he's exhausted and he doesn't know how to control this guy. And he thought he went over and they had a lot of phone calls and they had a lot of talks and he cleaned it up and put out statements. And now the guy's like gone rogue on him again. And so Lindsey's reaction is that he has to go on CBN to threaten his hold on this group of voters. I mean, this is really, it's staggering.
This is staggering, because when you go on, you go on Christian Broadcast Network, you go on the 700 Club, you use words like Obama and Elizabeth Warren, you're firing real bullets. In right-wing politics, this is real bullets. You are, you know, risking real damage to the president at a very vulnerable part. So this is a fascinating moment right now.
Yeah, I didn't think Lindsey Graham had it in him, but that's no small move to go over to CBN and do that. But I can understand him. He doesn't. This is also part of the conversation you and Bill had. There's no one who can, you know, protect us from these rash decisions and impulsive phone calls and erratic behavior and, you know, no briefings and gut stable genius, you know, winging it and everything. There's nobody home. No, I mean, Lindsey Graham, how many hours do you think he's spent since October 6th when this tweet went out about the Turkish incursion? that the Trump, that President Trump basically admitted he was greenlighting. How many hours do you think Lindsey Graham has spent either on the phone with the guy or at the White House?
Yeah. And, I mean, what else has he been doing? Yeah. You know, what else has he got going? A.B. Stoddard, thank you so much for spending all the time with us, and appreciate
Thanks,
it very, very much on a very,
An
very busy
day.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you again by Plexaderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.